Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Etam santam I wanted to give a little bit of a talk this evening on the topic of pace. And some time ago, I was reading some reflections on the classic Indian epic, the Mahabharata. And one of the commenters on the Mahabharata raised the question of what was the dominant flavor of that particular text. And it's a very curious thing, because if you're familiar with the Mahabharata, the Mahabharata is the most opulent, crowded, complex, twisted, conflicted work of art probably that's ever been produced. The variety of stories, the violence, the depth of the conflict, the wars, and so on. And it includes just about anything that you could possibly imagine. So that the Mahabharata itself says that it contains all the flavors. So just as a side note on here, when I'm using the word flavor, it's actually a technical term in Indian literary theory. The word flavor is rasa. And each literary or aesthetic work, artistic work, is supposed to have a particular rasa, a particular flavor which characterizes it. And Mahabharata claims itself to be so vast and so all-inclusive that it contains all of the rasas, all of the flavors. And yet, one of the commenters, one of the great commenters writing on it, says that the flavor of the Mahabharata is the Shanta Rasa, the flavor of peace. And this is a very striking comment. How can this work, which is as vibrant, as complex, as paradoxical, as life itself, how can this thing have that flavor of peace? Seems like Mahabharata really should have every flavor except for peace. And the answer to this riddle, the answer to this paradox, is that the Mahabharata, because it includes everything, it allows everything. Just in that is the peace of it. Everything in life happens, is recorded and reported without flinching, without favoring and opposing, without excluding things. Everything is just in there, and the peace is a container for the thing as a whole. And so even though you can't identify anything about it that's actually peaceful, and yet the work as a whole conveys this unexpressed flavor of peace. And the commentator remarks on this, and he says that it's just like whenever refined people come together for conversation, that they never explicitly mention the thing that's closest to their heart, but will always suggest it and imply it, and leave the heart of the matter unspoken. Because what's unspoken, what's implied, will communicate more meaningfully than something that's said overtly. And so in the Mahabharata, it's the very avoidance of peace as an explicit flavor that gives it that flavor overall. I thought it's a very wonderful reflection on the Mahabharata, and because the Mahabharata mirrors very much life itself, then it's a reflection on life. So when we're looking for peace, that search for peace, which is motivating our spiritual life, where are we going to find it? What things are we going to find peace in? What times can we set aside so that we can be peaceful? What activities can we do that can bring us peace? And as long as we keep thinking in this way, then we're separating peace out from our life. We're making it into something which is separate from who we are, what we do. And so we never really find the essence of peace. We keep on losing it. We keep on searching for it. And I was saying the other day, like in the American Constitution, it says that all, they hold these rights to be innate, that everyone has a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so, of course, life and liberty are things that you have a right to. Happiness you don't have a right to. You've got a right to pursue it. You've got a right to seek it. But, of course, you only seek for things that you don't have. Isn't that true? If you've already got it, you're not going to be seeking it. So, in other words, you're guaranteed the right to not be happy, because you're guaranteed to have that right to always be seeking happiness. And in that seeking, you're never going to actually be happy, by definition. Happiness is that peace and contentment that's no longer seeking for anything. And of course, what a perfect description of, if you like, the American way of life or modern consumerist way of life, that is. We always have that right to be seeking happiness, pursuing something, looking for the next thing to eat, or the next gadget to have, or the next show to watch, or the next thing to do. And so we have that right to seek happiness, but we don't have the right to actually have happiness, to actually be happiness, to be contentment, to be peace. There was one of the, I heard a story once about one of the great contemporary rishis in the south of India. I can't remember his name now, but he was regarded as one of the great saints in that meditation tradition, and had inspired many people, and was regarded as an enlightened master. And he received a transmission from his teacher, and his teacher said to him two words: be still. Only those two words. That was the entire teaching. Be still. That's it. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what would happen if you took that as the theme and the teaching for your life? Everything else doesn't matter. Just those two words, be still. And if you're able to really do that, to really embody that, no matter what is happening, no matter where you are, no matter who you're talking to, no matter what life throws at you, just to be still. So the more, this is one of the great paradoxes of the spiritual life, is that the more we're searching for peace, the more we're trying to get it, the more we think of peace as something which is separate from us, something which is over there, something we have to climb a great mountain to find peace at the top. We have to forge through the thickets and the forests to find peace. We have to cross the treacherous oceans to find peace. And of course, the truth is that whenever we're making any of these journeys, these spiritual journeys, we're taking that peace with us. It's with us right from the start. So when we're talking about peace, of course, in a social sense, when people use that in our society, usually they mean peace is the absence of war. So like war is the opposite of peace. And it's something that we all want. Everybody wants to be at peace. Nobody likes to be at war. We all want peace. And we think of, and peace is in a sense is defined as an absence. So if we're not at war, then we're at peace. But what is actually happening at that time when we're not at war? Well, of course, life goes on, doesn't it? Everything happens. That's when crops get planted. That's when roads get built. It's when paintings get painted. It's when scientific discoveries get made. That's the whole of life happens within peace, just like in the Mahabharata. And that state of war and that state of conflict is really just a suppression of life. It's the opposite of life. So war and peace, even though they're in a sense are opposites, like day and night, or hot and cold, but they're not opposites that require each other, are they? You know, you can't have day without night, you can't have summer without winter. Many of the opposites that we have, we can't have dark without light. Many of the opposites that we have, they require each other. But war and peace aren't like that, are they? It's quite possible to have a state of peace without having any war. There's no theoretical reason why countries shouldn't just be at peace, solve their differences through discussion, and through whatever, setting up legal channels or whatever, and not have war. It's entirely conceivable that that could be the case. There's nothing paradoxical or particularly hard to understand about it. And so it's the same in our lives when we're practicing Dhamma. The practice of Dhamma, as we conventionally say, leads to peace. But we have to be careful when we're using the language of Dhamma. We use words like the Eightfold Path, you know, like practice and so on. We use these words so often that we forget that they're just metaphors. They're just metaphors. They're just playing with words. That's all. There's no such thing as a path. There's no such thing as practice. These are just words that we use to point and to try to describe experience. So when we look inside ourselves, when we contemplate inside our own mind and body, what do we see? Do we see peace? Do we see conflict? Keep on looking. Look closer. Look more carefully. See that there are two different attitudes or perspectives that we can have on that. From one attitude, which is the conventional attitude that we tend to come from, is that we have conflict, we have stress inside our body. We can feel the pains, the aches, the tensions, the different parts of our body fighting each other, and that through doing practices, we can do breathing meditation or yoga or other kinds of mindfulness practice, and gradually those points of tension will disappear, our body will come to rest, and there'll be a stillness there. Or similar and interrelated process can be observed in our mind, that where mind's thinking about different things, this and that, emotions about this and that, memories, imagination, mind going off here and there, doing this and that. And then we meditate, we apply ourselves with mindfulness to a meditation object, keep on bringing that to mind, and then gradually, through the repetition of that meditation object, the tendency of the mind to stray becomes disciplined, the mind becomes unified, and it will settle down together with that object and reach a point of oneness. So this is how we meditate, this is how we practice, and this is one way of looking at things, and of course it's a perfectly good way of looking at things. But if we look a little bit more deeply into it, we see that even that way of talking about it, even though we're talking about experience, is actually itself based on a set of concepts. Because we might think, for example, that we're following a meditation technique. But a meditation technique is just another set of concepts, isn't it? Reality is, at any one moment, what's happening in your mind. Not the technique which is trying to help you look into your mind, but what's actually happening at that point in your mind. And of course, there's no meditation technique there. When I practice metta meditation, there's no one point in that practice where that technique exists. The technique is just a set of concepts and descriptions which is used to describe and direct the meditation, that's all. But at that moment, there's nothing there. And so if there's just that experience, there's no path, there's no method, there's just an experience. And so the notion of being in a place of stress and going to a place of peace is revealed to be just another metaphor, just a way of looking at things, a way of communicating things. And then we realize that every moment just is what it is. Whatever's happening is just happening. The train's going by or it's not. The cicadas are trilling or they're not. Our knees are hurting or they're not. That's just what it is. It's just what's happening. And so when we look at it like that, then we realize that peace is not something which lives at the end of a road. It's not something which there's a long journey towards. Peace is something that happens when we stop the journey. Peace is what happens when we stop striving. Peace is what happens when we just are. When the Buddha described Nibbana as the third noble truth, a little Pali passage that I quoted at the beginning of this talk, Sabba Sankhara Samato. It's always the phrase in there that I like the best, Sabba Sankhara Samato. The Samatha, and here Samatha has its original meaning of the tranquilizing, the stilling, actually the evening. Of all sankharas, all activities, all conditions. And so here, as usual, the word sankhara has a very active sense. It doesn't mean formations. It means activities. It means the energies. And of course, as we know from physics, that the whole world is made of energy. What we call matter is just a highly structured and dense form of energy, that's all. So this whole world is energies, it's always moving, it's always interacting. There's no place of stillness in the world. Like when the Bodhisattva was going to go forth, as described in the Attadanda Sutta, and saying that every sabbe disa samerita, every direction, everywhere he looked, everything was tossed about. Everything was topsy-turvy. Well, that's how reality is, isn't it? And the more that modern physics has gone into the deep structure of matter, the more it's revealed that, well, there isn't any ground under our feet. There's no point of reference in the universe. There's no center. Everything just is in relation to everything else. And so we used to be able to think that literally the ground under our feet, that the earth, was a point of stability, that it remained solid and things revolved around it. We can't think that anymore. Everything's moving, everything's changing, and any notion of movement or stillness or peace or anything like that can only be defined in relationship to the rest of the universe. So this is that sabba-sankhara samato. And we think about all of those forces and all of those energies from the level of strings, if they exist, or quarks, or the various kinds of subatomic particles that have been postulated by modern physics. To the atoms, a kind of buzzing, changing fluxes of indefinable energy movements. Don't think of atoms like the planetary model that we got told at school, where you have the nucleus in the middle, one solid lump, and then electrons like planets circling around them like other solid lumps. Real atoms are nothing like that. It's just a 19th century model. And then the atoms form themselves into molecules, binding together. The binds always shifting, changing. Molecules forming various kinds of more complex substances that become the things that we encounter in the real world, from air to water to earth to metal to the organic chemistry in our bodies. And all of these things just made up of these energies moving in space. And the closer and closer you go down in them, the less solid they appear, the less easy it is to define them. But somehow, in all of this movement, We imagine that there's this world of solid things around us. We imagine that our body is somehow solid. We imagine that if we sit on a chair, that we're not just going to glum right through it. We imagine that the earth that we're traveling on is somehow still. We don't sort of get up in the morning and hold onto a handle to make sure we don't fall over, because the earth is spinning so fast. So then the spinning of the earth is then part of the spinning of the solar system, and then the spinning of the galaxy, and then the universe expanding outwards for billions of years, and then collapsing, crashing, nothing impermanent, nothing permanent, nothing stable in that whole process. And this goes on and on and on, countless times, countless universes, never stopping. One universe leading to the next, on and on and on and on and on. And maybe even more exotic forms of instability, the parallel universes, or new universes born out of the chaos of a black hole. We don't know. These are just more kind of exotic theories. But whether or not they're true, there's no doubt that the universe as a whole is impermanent and unstable. And so where do we find peace in all of this? How can something like peace come to be in a world which is so thoroughly built out of movement, out of conflict, out of energy? How can there possibly be this sabba sankhara samato? You know, out of all of the phenomena that we are aware of in the world, the mind is the most, I think, the most extraordinary, the most complex, the most subtle, the most subject to change. These kind of infinite variety of different dimensions and different perspectives, and it's because of its very illusory and fantastical nature that there's almost nothing to it. It's like this kind of ghost or magic trick. It hardly, even when you're experiencing inside your mind, it seems hard to pin it down as really existing. So chairs and cars and floors, you know, they're much more straightforward things, but our mind is hard to even find, hard to even know what we're talking about, and yet it's so powerful. And the human mind is the most powerful force, for good or for ill. And somehow in the human mind, in our consciousness, there is the key to unlocking this multi-dimensional labyrinth of complexity and movement and conflict that we call samsara. And it's something to do with the capacity of the mind to reflect. And this is something the mind does better than anything else. Let's think about it just for a minute, using some very concrete imagery. Let's say I have a tennis ball, and maybe I'm wanting to play with the tennis ball, and I throw the tennis ball against the wall side of the house, and it bounces off. Now, in that particular case, I expect that I can throw my ball against the side of the house as many times as I like, thousands of times, and I'm not even going to notice the slightest difference in the wall. The wall's just going to repel the ball. The ball's going to come to me. So in that case, it seems like, to any observer, it would seem as if the wall's completely impervious. It's stuck, it's rigid, and only the tennis ball has its direction changed. But of course, if we look at it much more closely, we realize that that's not the case. If you examined it, for example, on a molecular level, you'd find that the molecules that make up the bricks, that the orbits of the electrons in those molecules would actually be affected by the tennis ball, when the tennis ball hits, there's a coming together of energies, the negative energies of the electron clouds in their respective objects would affect each other, they'd push each other away. And so each time you throw the ball at the wall itself is actually changing, it's responding, it's reflecting. Now if you think about another situation which is much more equal, for example, playing billiards, and you hit one ball and it hits another ball. Well, in that case you think that they're more or less equal, that in that case that both balls are going to be affected in their motion more or less equally, because each has a similar mass. But again, notice how that there's this feedback. It's not just that one is affecting the other, it's not just that the other is affecting the one, but both of them are affecting each other. And how both of them are will affect what happens. If instead of having a billiard ball on the table you have a tennis ball, well, it's going to behave differently. If you hit a billiard ball into a ping pong ball, for example, it's going to behave very differently. Because the ping pong ball is so light. So in nature and in the world, everything has this reflective capacity to some degree. Everything affects everything else. Everything's always feeding back into everything else. There's no such thing as a one-way causality, really. That's just another one of these constructs which we imagine in our minds to try to make things simple so we can understand them. And if even in the world of material things that there's this feedback happening constantly, then how much more so is that happening in the mind, which is far, far more subtle and more refined than any of those physical things. And so in our mind, whatever's happening, whenever our mind gets hit by a tennis ball or a billiard ball or a ping pong ball or anything else, it's always somehow shifting and responding to that in this very complex organic way. We can see a correlation of that to some degree in our brain activity through MRI scans. But even that is only coarse, it's only crude, it's not really seeing the thing itself. And so in our meditation, we observe all of these things. We observe how the mind is reacting to any activity, how it's moving out through its desires, trying to get something, moving through its aversion, trying to push things away, trying to hurt. And we see the confusion, the unknowing in the mind, the darkness. And so these forces arising within the mind itself are constantly interacting with everything that we perceive outside. And everything we perceive outside is constantly reacting with everything that we see that's coming up from inside the mind. And each of those things is changing and the interactions are changing themselves and everything's constantly moving. It's moving even faster in more fluid and less predictable ways than anything in the material world. And yet somehow in that there's peace. Somehow in that movement we can still find peace. And we do that training of the mind, the Buddhist training of the mind, paying attention to our meditation objects, practicing sense restraint, keeping our sila, practicing solitude, not talking too much, trying to find moderation in how we do things. So we do all of that. But that's not the thing itself, that's the pursuit of the thing. The thing itself is the peace. It's the space which is always there. Again, to come back to these physical metaphors that I've been using, if you think about an atom again, I describe an atom as like whirring, changing, spiraling, spinning energies. That's that's reasonable enough to take on what an atom is. But another way of saying is that an atom is just space. Actually, virtually all of an atom, there's nothing there. There's only a tiny, tiny bit in there where there's an actual disturbance. And the rest of it is nothing. And the same thing in our universe on the macro scale, isn't it? Yeah, we think, what's in our universe? Well, there's the stars, there's the sun, there's the planets, there's the asteroids, galaxies and so on. But actually what there is, mostly, about 99% of it, is space. Much more than 99%. I don't know how many 0.9s I have to put in there to actually get there. Mainly because we don't know where the end of the universe is. It's just space. For someone like myself, I used to be a great science fiction geek. So I love stories about space and films about space and things like that. And with almost every story about space, commits the unforgivable sin of having far, far too many things in it. And I think probably of all the films that I saw when I was younger, probably the only one was maybe 2001, Space Odyssey, where it gives this tremendous feeling of the emptiness and the slowness of space, the kind of the endless, endless miles with nothing happening. But of course, to make a story, you can't make too many stories about nothing happening. You have to make story, have to make things to make a story. But the bigger the container, then the more weight and the more profundity that those actions have. And again, this comes back to that notion of the Mahabharata as being the having the flavor of peace. And it's the very fact of the peace that surrounds all of those events in some way. The acceptance that surrounds them, that gives them a weight and a power and a beauty. And it's the same thing in our life. If we have that quality of peace, that quality of acceptance, quality of whatever happens, we just be with it, then everything that we do gains a sense of meaning, gains a sense of significance. It's like if you see a painting in a junk shop where it's piled on a table together with a dozen other paintings in a room chock-a-block full of things, then the painting looks like nothing. But if you buy it, you take it home and you put it on a wall where it's alone on that wall with a great space around it, then you can actually see the beauty of it. It stands out. You can say, my goodness, I never suspected that painting was so lovely. And so this is that flavor of peace which we can bring to our lives if we live them well. And so that no matter what happens to us, because stuff will happen, birth will happen, aging and death, and our loved ones will get old and get sick, there will be conflict, there will be differences. All of those things are going to happen whether you like it or not. And so it's our choice and our skill, our wisdom, if we can bring that quality of peace to whatever happens. So this is my little talk for you this evening on peace, and I offer this for your contemplation. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or reflections.
Okay. How do you then define peace?
I'd rather not if I didn't have to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I'm a bit confused. Because it seems to me, unless I know what you mean by the peace, if your life is like the Mahabharata, and there's all sorts of stuff happening, lots of conflicts, maybe bad stuff, good stuff. And you just sort of say, oh yeah, whatever. This is what's the difference between complacency and peace in that sort of situation or life? Or?
Well, the difference is if you're worrying about it, you're not peaceful.
Yeah, but what if you need to worry about it?
You don't need to worry about it.
Well, there might be a definition of what you mean by worrying. Well, you need to
have
that things.
Yeah, so you just do what needs to be done and don't worry about it. It's the worrying about it which stops the peace.
What's peace then?
No worries.
There's an Irish blessing about peace,
uh-huh.
And the last line is, deep peace of the running way to you.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Well, you could have other ways as well. But I think, yeah, that's the original one. It's beautiful, yeah. And a good blessing for obviously from our fishing folk. Used to the rough seas of the North Sea. Yeah.
I think worry comes from control.
Uh-huh.
Being your object. The stuff of the subject or the object within.
Uh-huh.
Worry.
Yeah.
I feel that it's kind of trying to control what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just letting things be.
I had an amazing experience of peace once. It was very profound. I don't think I've ever had it as like that before.
Mm.
That James and I were having an argument. And I was sort of sitting on the bed reading a book, saying, I'm just trying to sort of let it go, just let it go. And I heard James come through the back door, and he was fuming down the passage, down the hallway. And I just had this absolute amazing feeling of peace and just letting it all go. And James got to the bedroom door, went, oh, I'm going to the shoot. And it ended the conflict, and I honestly don't think we've ever had that level of argument again. So to me, peace is letting go, you know, not trying to control it or make it work out your way. And it was a most amazing, absolutely amazing deep feeling. And I think once you have a feeling of that type of peace, then you never forget it.
Mm.
You know, so
that's beautiful. Yeah.
Kind of cool.
Mm.
Did you have to disturb other people's peace to get your own peace? Mm. Or what if you want other people's peace and then you have to disturb your own peace?
Mm. Well, again, if you're worrying about it, then you're not peaceful. But I think that example of Pat's is really lovely because it shows that very often, that conflict has to come, you know, it's a complex. It's not just something that exists in your mind, but something which is mirrored in other people's minds as well. So, it can sometimes be dissolved in that way. But, you know, in that case, you know, that was a particular case just to use that example with Pat and James, because they're obviously very close. They've been married for many years, so obviously that, you know, come much closer with other people, maybe not so powerful. But, you know, you always just need to be, and if you're dealing with that thing, if there's a genuine competition of interest, then you just try to do your best to make sure everyone's as happy as possible. But then there's also a perspective of just looking at it and realizing, well, conflict happens in the world, and at the end of the day, not everybody's going to be happy with the outcome. And sometimes that's going to be me, sometimes it's going to be other people.
I think most of people steward their own peace rather than actually being steward by others. As they go out and actually make trouble inside, you steward their peace, actually.
Sure.
They've gone out and feeling
Okay, let's finish up by paying respects.
Bhagavato Sāmi.